It's Wednesday, August 27th, 2008, and you're listening to episode 113 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 54 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
And I'm Pat.
And Chris is not here tonight because he's all tied up.
All tied up. In the back of my trunk.
Getting plowed.
Back of your trunk.
We went with two different jokes
there. It's a spacious
there.
Trunk. Yeah.
All right. Anyway. No, you can combine those jokes. I mean, they're...
I don't think they're being a
fool. I don't judge, dude. Whatever gets you through the night.
For that in a trunk. But I'm sure somebody listening has a story to prove us wrong.
Like, oh, I'm sure.
A continental, you know.
All right.
Three bodies back there.
Where Chris really is, he's doing...
I haven't seen that many dead hookers in a trunk in a long time.
Chris is doing a draft tonight for his fantasy football league, which actually does bring something up I want to mention. A couple people have been asking on the forums or an email exactly...
What the hell you do for a living?
Outside of sit around and watch History Channel. So, I want to go ahead and mention, we just finished a...
And by we, you mean you and your business partner, not Pat and I.
Right, yeah.
I have nothing
not
to do with
the two
this.
Of you, yeah. Me and Christian and a guy named Jeff. We just finished a fantasy football program that we're going to be doing for Miller. And this is something that you can play at, by the way, so only applies to people in the U.S. We are thinking about going overseas with some stuff for soccer in the future, but that's not been done yet. So right now, it's only American football in the U.S. But if you live there... If you go to a site, it's FS for Fantasy Sports Challenge.com, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes. There's a store finder on there. Put in your zip code. Try to find a store near you. Completely free to play. All you have to do is go into the restaurant, ask them for a card. It'll give you a code. Go home. You pick out a team. And we simplified the draft process because we can't do a full-blown detailed draft with thousands of people playing. And then that restaurant will have prizes they'll hand out to both weekly and seasonal winners. So you've got a pretty good chance of winning. So if you want to know what I do during the day, I'll put a link to one of my projects in the show notes. The other stuff I work in is
really boring.
Well, it's insurance software, and I don't really know how to show that off. And it's really boring on top of that.
Yeah.
So we'll just skip over that. Gen Con, we'll keep this real quick. We don't. Yeah.
I think everybody's doing Gen Con reports, so we won't bore
We're
you
not.
With ours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We do want to say one thing, though, real quick. Which is a big thanks to our Toft Bitches.
Oh, the Toft Bitches. Mighty they were.
Chad, what does Toft Bitches stand for?
Toft Bitch is an acronym. It stands for the Official Fear the Boot Communications Hub. And when you write that out, it looks a lot like Toft Bitch. And we had three of them. We had Toft Bitch 1, 2, and 3. And that was Dan, not you, Dan,
not
different
me.
Grungy Dan.
Grungy Dan.
Christian, which is Zeke Copper Eyes, and Ed, which is Ender...
Melchior.
And, basically what it was is that, we figured that we thought of doing this, 3 days before the con started. And one of us, I forget who it was, had this great idea, and it's just like, okay, we take volunteers who have, cell phones, and then people PM them on the forums with their name and their cell phone number if they're going to Gen Con. And then these guys act as a communications hub. Somebody calls up for Fear the Boot. Somebody calls them up and says, hey, where's the next Fear the Boot event? Or one of the Fear the Boot guys or somebody else is like, hey, I'm looking for a couple of people to play a game. And they're like, oh, well, I three guys just called me up looking for a game. I'll hook you guys up. And or somebody's like, dude, we need wings. We need beer tonight. Nothing's going on. And then they put the call out to everybody on the Toft Bitch list. And, we all just get together. It worked fantastic. It worked really well for the small amount of people who signed up for it. And the small amount of people who signed up for it was just because we only thought of it a couple of days before the con. I think that next year, God willing, this podcast is still going. Gen Con is still there and we're all gaming. We're going to do it again, and we're going to kind of do it more in advance, too.
Yeah, and we all thanks to these guys, because they worked
totally
hard.
Voluntary, yeah. And they were busting their butt for us and, providing their cell phone, getting interrupted, and they're just there trying to enjoy the con, and it was awesome, guys. Thank you very much. Big thumbs up.
GM profile today, we're going to do Pat, and this is going to be...
Quick.
Yeah, well, maybe not quick, but it's going to be kind of different than the other ones, because, Pat, you don't GM.
That's so true.
We still have to do Chris and I for regular GMing. And we'll actually have GM styles
for correct GMing. Right,
not none of that Chad crap.
But
Pat doesn't even GM, and I'm curious to hear why.
Now, have you ever GM'd in the past? You have GM'd.
I have. I ran a campaign about 8 years ago. I ran a third edition D&D campaign for the group that I was playing with, and it was the original group that I started role playing with. And what they actually wanted to do, they wanted to play sort of an epic level characters, mm-hmm. like, you know, higher level characters that could do like massive amounts of damage and all this kind of stuff. So they were running like, you know, 20th level characters from there up. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll take this on and run through a campaign. What I learned from the experience is how really difficult it is to GM. There's a lot of work involved. You know, you've got to come up with a story. You've got to come up with
how did you approach it? How did you GM that one game? Let's just take a single shot GM.
Okay.
Because I want to understand if your bad GMing experience was because of
bad GMing.
Well, yeah. Or just poor choices in how you approached it, that the style you use doesn't actually fit how you think.
Well, I'll say this. I don't think it was a terribly, I wouldn't call it a bad experience GMing. I think it went okay. It's just that I learned from it that this is not really something that I excel at, that I would want to do, because there's a lot of work involved in it.
And, right.
I like to play in somebody else's story. I guess I'm, as far as coming up with my own stories, I'm not as creative in that sense, I guess. Like I'm not a writer or stuff like that. And in the few times that I've done a creative thing like that, where be it, you know, writing or whatever, it takes me quite a while to come up with it. I'm notoriously bad about my own characters when I role play, coming up with a backstory.
Yeah,
coming, you know, that kind of a thing. That's a
Well, you did pretty good in the Cyberpunk game.
Well, you know what helped though, that when we did that, we at least you and I or the group, we sort of came up with it at the table, and I'm pretty good at that. Like I've always been able to sit down with my gaming friends in a world situation and sort of brainstorm some ideas.
I do better with that too.
Writing
a character profile.
Well, and then so you flip that over to GMing and you lose that, because unless you just start giving the story away, you've got to come up with it all on your own. And so I don't even remember like the storyline that I had. I just know that I had some kind of an overall, you know, some bad guy for them to go out and fight, and they were sort of marching along toward it. I will say this, it was pretty darn linear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was not able to pull in all of the intrigue and varying plot points for them to sort of pick and choose from. It was, again, I was green and I, you know, the plot wagon sort of came into this, that,
so,
and the other.
Okay. So the issue, if I'm following you right, was not per se that the work was too much, or that you couldn't roll what was going on. It's just you struggled with the creativity to come up with the ideas. Is that correct?
I think that's a good part of it. Yeah. There's so much that you've got to do to really, you know, to have a world that you're going to have them, you know, play in, or a good story.
Did you ever try running modules or pre-written games?
No, I didn't.
And you're a better man for it.
well, it could have helped. I think that's, if for somebody that's never done it before, I think if you're going to start fresh, you're going to start, you say you're starting with a group that you haven't done it before, I think modules would probably be a good way just to cut your teeth on it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I think that you should pretty darn quickly move beyond them, but I think that might be a good idea for that. And I think the reason that I didn't is that I'd been role playing at that point for probably 10 years. So I'm like, I don't really need to do that. I don't think it's just a matter of sitting down with the DMG and the monsters manual, putting together some fights and that. Now I will say the other part of it that made it hard was, again, they were playing 20th level characters, which essentially, I mean, these were like D&D gods.
Right.
They are going to be able to do, you know, just massive amounts of damage. And again, it was the third edition rules, which you had all these feats and all these combo strikes, and it was sick. I mean, anything that I could throw against them, they were probably just going to be able to annihilate. But if they weren't, then the monster itself was probably, you know,
was
so powerful,
kill them.
If I wasn't careful, it could just wipe them out with, you know, by pointing its finger. So you walk a line there too. I think that makes it harder. I think that's why you don't see a whole lot of those epic level games. Yeah,
that was definitely not a good choice, because whenever you've got new game master, new group of players, any number of situations, it's going to already upset the balance of the game. Introducing any kind of an experimental element in there always ends in disaster. I'm sure somebody's had a game like that went well, but every game like that I have seen, has ended in absolute disaster.
Now, you're saying experimental games ending disaster, or are you saying the combination?
Oh, I'm in the combination of the two, where you've already got a lot of uncertainty because you have a new GM, new players, new system, whatever the case may be. And then you decide to spice up an already unstable.
That's one of the issues that we have with our current gaming group, is that, you know, we're all still trying to find our way with each other and find out, you know, what this person likes, what they don't like, and how I can compromise my views and everybody can have a good time. And then everybody at the table, though, is a really experienced role player.
Exactly.
But we're not really experienced with each other. So everybody wants to try, hey, this really new system, or hey, I got this really wacky story concept, or I want to do this crazy, cool role-playing character. And it's just like, let's, you know, we this last game that we had kind of fell apart for that reason, is that we have to roll it back, and we're like, listen, let's start basic.
Right.
Let's get back to basics.
And there's the exact problem that we don't tend to think about the fact that the group kind of has its own experience level that goes along with it.
Yeah.
We may be very experienced role players, but whenever you get a new group of people, you still have to feel out what it is everyone wants out of the game, what everyone's style of play is, the things the GM wants from the players that he's not saying, but just kind of assumes you're going to take care of.
Right.
And none of that stuff has lined up because we just kind of assumed that, hey, we did great in our previous group. So
that was the great thing about my old group, is that they weren't role players. Some of them had, like, they were varying degrees of experience, but for on the average is that they were very inexperienced. And I was introducing this concept of gaming to them.
And from your standpoint, you wouldn't have attempted to shoot to the end point. So you were starting at the start yourself.
Yeah.
And so none of those assumptions got brought to bear.
Actually, that was a really cool thing, because with your old group, or the group when I used to role play with you, I never GM'd. I think I GM'd like one thing for you guys, and that was just kind of like this really weird experiment thing that I was doing. And I went for years and years and years and didn't role play. And then I had this group of basically noobs.
Mm-hmm.
None of them were going to run a game. They didn't even know what gaming was for the most part. And so I had to take the reins. And that was a really cool experience for me, because I really got to explore what a role-playing game was through teaching. You know how they always say it's like, you know, the teacher learns as much as the student type of thing. And usually that's a bunch of twaddle, I think. But, you know, in this case,
I thought he was going to say something much more obscene there. So
no, I watched far too much British television. But yeah, I learned a lot. I learned a lot of like what did work and what didn't work. I really defined my style. And I think I really helped ruin those people on role-playing games. But this is how you play role-playing games. It's like, no, that's not how you play at all. That's Chad's weird way of doing things. But, you know, they go off and they still role-play.
That's good, though. It's a different experience. And I think any role player should be exposed to all these different kinds of styles. If you just play one style or one game for your entire role-playing career, you're missing out on a lot, and you really can't, you're not a well-rounded player.
I totally and absolutely agree with you. I mean, I have played everything from the kind of very story non-rules games that I'll enjoy running to hardcore hack and slash. Does this character even have a name?
You know, it's not important.
Yeah. It's like
Deathbringer.
Three pages of abilities and equipment, but he doesn't have a name on there. And it's just like, yeah, and I've done all that. And that's something like our current group. That's something that I really am always pushing. Like the guys who also listen to this show and are going to listen to this and give me crap about for it, the guys, they don't, it's like, I don't want this kind of game. I want this kind of game. I don't want this kind of game, and I'll never play that kind of game.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? Those are the games I'm pushing for, the games that they don't want to play, and the games that, because it, yeah, I mean, there's no such thing as a bad. There's terrible games that you can make good. Shadowrun. Horrible game. Well, I've had great times playing it.
We were talking about doing a Star Trek game. One of the guys was concerned, oh, it's just going to be a fandom wipe. It's like, no, it can be that way.
Yeah.
But it doesn't at all need to be that way. So
I would absolutely love running a Doctor Who time travel game.
Oh, God, that'd be awesome.
With absolutely no Doctor Who in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you never meet the Doctor.
Well, sure.
So, Pat, getting back to your game.
Uh-huh.
So, how did you prepare for the game? What kinds of notes did you bring to the table? Where'd you get your inspiration from? Since apparently you struggled quite a bit.
Oh my God, we did totally tangent off of that.
That's okay.
We?
Yeah, like wildly, I said, so. we'll go off and come back to it because, you know, like again, there's as far as a GM profile, there's not much to profile, so it's good. Get some different in there. Let's see. I came prepared with a lot of notes and stuff again because I had to have something lined out for them. I did have a story. Like I said, I'm blanking on what it was at the moment. I had a game. I remember I had a not a manila folder, but one of the school folders, you know, that you can put
right
papers in the flaps on. That was my folder. It had maps and pages. I had a pad of graph paper that I used to.
Did you have NPC descriptions?
I did. Yeah. Like I had very few recurring NPCs, but I would prepare the villains or whatever, you know, cause that's the other thing. You had to go through and you had to generate them pretty much, you know,
right.
Cause I was going to have to generate like a 25th or 30th level character
and
for
also
them.
Generating
throw all this kind of crap in there for them to be able to do. And
it also takes a while.
Exactly.
Pumping out like a level one farmer doesn't take too much. Taking a character and trying to level them up to 20.
Uh-huh.
That takes a while.
It does. Oh, I remember when I did this, it's funny. And it's starting to flood back to me now. I remember I actually wrote myself a script, like some macros or whatever in Excel to help me to do this because I had to keep track of not only my NPCs, but I kept track of the player character stuff just to know what they were, you know, what their stats were, what they were able to do, how easy it was going to be, you know, what their Thaco was, what are they going to be, how are they, you know, what their weapon skills are, just to sort of know what I kind of needed to make. So I would generate, you know, a character and then I'd go through and give them all the feats and do this, that, and the other, and all that would go into generating the numbers because I tried to make it as easy for myself as possible once I sat down to the table to be able to, instead of being bogged down in all the die rolls and all the rules, I could have something to glance at and say, okay, this is what I need to hit so-and-so. This is what I need to hit, you know, so-and-so. And then I could just roll it up. Sorry, I shouldn't peck the table.
You shouldn't do that.
My bad. To be able to hurry things along. Well, not hurry things along, but not to be bogged down in that, to try to be able to tell the story instead of being going, okay, I got to make 10 rolls here, guys, just hold on. So yeah, it was a lot of work. And I remember I spent a lot of time, you know, in my off time and whatever else, just generating all these, you know, the bad guys to do that. And again, that was also part of it's third edition. And it was also the high level characters. Now, with that all being said, interestingly enough, the campaign didn't like go down in flames. It just sort of stopped. I mean, we played it for a while and then eventually, and that's the thing that group did. We didn't like ever end campaign sort of like mm-hmm. we do around like what I'm used to in recent history.
Right.
It was just that we would play for a while and then all of a sudden we'd lose interest. So we just wouldn't play that anymore. We'd move on to something else. It's like we had all these loose ends out there mm-hmm. that were not really officially closed. We didn't say, no, we're done with this campaign. It's, you know, we'll go on to something else. We just wouldn't play it anymore. And that's kind of what happened there. So I think the players enjoyed it because what it gave for them, it gave them the ability to do a real hack and slash. And that's what they wanted. They wanted, it's like, okay, let's play this thing where we're just going to go in and we're just going to slaughter because that's what we're good at. I mean, we're high level characters. We're melee wagons. And, mm-hmm. and that's what I provided for them. It was kind of a, you know, it was a fluff kind of a thing. And they enjoyed it. I did enjoy running it other than the, you know, even though it was a lot of work and everything. But like I said, what I took away from it is that, yeah, this probably really isn't for me.
Yeah.
So
would you consider GMing again? Or is that final note there? This isn't for me. Really, you're closing. Is that the period at the end of that sentence?
I will. Let me just, you know, from the classic Bond reference, never say never. So yeah, I'll leave it with that.
Yeah.
I'm not jumping to or itching to. I have nothing in mind. I don't have a calling to say right now. I'd love to run so and so, but I'll never say I will never do it again.
Did you come up with any kind of advice from that whole thing that you could pass on to other people?
Don't play third edition.
What confused me? I saw a third edition made at Thaco, which would be second edition. So
actually, you're right. Did they still have?
No,
Thaco was second.
There was no Thaco in there, was there? Yeah, because they did everything. Even the armor classes were all different. It was just a totally different way of doing things. I would say the advice that I would have for anyone that is considering GMing a game, running a game for a group, is just go into it with your eyes open to the fact that it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And appreciate whoever is behind that GM screen for the amount of work and time and effort that they have to put into it. It's just, it's a lot of work to do. It has given me a great respect. Having done it once, I have much more. I have a great deal of respect for those people that run it because I know how hard it is.
Yeah.
So I would say it's probably something that everyone should do once just to experience that side of the game. Because
I agree.
You know,
well, you know what I appreciate most about you, Pat, is the fact that you GM'd and then came back and said, GMing's not for me. You're not the guy who sucks at GMing and won't stop. And so then everyone has to come up with all these kind of weird political maneuverings to stop them from ever getting the GM chair to begin with.
And you know, another thing he said that I completely agree with is that, I think that if you play role-playing games for any length of time, you should GM at least once so that you have an appreciation for it. I mean, I told this story many times is that I had a group of players that would routinely
disrespect
the GM. I mean, we would always joke around and kid with each other, but it's just like they would do things and not
just try to sabotage the plot or throw a monkey wrench into
things. I don't even want to say they would throw the plot off the rails because I really don't like using the railroad, you know, but it's more of, you know, like, I said I wouldn't kill anybody, so Adam walks right in front of the tank and lifts his arms out because he knew the tank wasn't going to shoot him, or if it did, he wasn't going to die.
Right.
And it was things like that, and I just got so frustrated, and also out of game stuff, like, you know, I did all the work as a GM, or I did a lot of work as a GM, and they would just be like, okay, run the game, entertain me, dance monkey type thing. Uh-huh. And they weren't that bad, but it was just little things like that. And it got to a point to where I said, screw it. Everybody around this table, and there were like seven of us, right, is going to GM. And then that's when I did the rotating GM game. You get 2 weeks. You have an optional third week, but no more than that. And everything you do gets handed to the next person in line, and they you let it go, and they are allowed to do anything they want with it for 2 weeks with the optional third, and then it moves on, and then there's a rotation.
Same game.
Same game, same characters.
Like that. That sounds cool.
It was so much fun, and I
would even do that.
I want to do it again.
We did that once before. Chad, this would have been back when you and I were gaming in the same first group. Mm-hmm. We did a D&D game because every person in there that GM'd had their own little pet realm. I did Forgotten Realms. Kevin did Dragonlance, Mike did Ravenloft. And so what we did was we would play, like, I had the characters for a certain level range.
Right.
And then they would leave that realm, and the same characters, the next GM now takes over in their little realm or whatever. We just would keep going, keep the campaign running like that.
Like, you kind of did jumping to realm during the Mists of Ravenloft or Portal or whatever. It was the same world, and it was the same plot. Like, I started it off. And I introduced a bad guy and a plot and a story that was kind of nothing deep, just sort of a bare bones for everyone to work with. And then I handed that off, and they kind of kept that ball rolling. I think we made like maybe two rotations around, maybe one, maybe two. And it was just a lot of fun. It was really cool to see, to hand that, what you've created, what you've introduced to the plot. And like the enemies, the bad guys, the good guys, the NPCs, the places they've been, the things they've done, and hand that off, because it gets totally reinterpreted.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I handed off this one of our players, this woman, and it was just like she started reinterpreting things. And I was just like, oh, no, that's so wrong. That's not what I thought. But I couldn't say anything because that was one of the rules we spelled out in there. When you hand it off, you hand it off and let it go. And they could, your main big bad, you know, dragon fire breathing destroying cities, and you hand it off to the girl, and the dragon transforms into a unicorn,
exactly,
and just barfs rainbows everywhere. That's her thing. That's all. You change it back to a dragon when it gets to you,
exactly.
But
I really awesome. And see, like I said a minute ago, I said never say never. Just that little story there, I would do that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got me interested, because for one thing, I can handle being, you know, running like, say, one adventure. If I've got 2 or 3 weeks to run it, that's a small scope.
Compact,
I can work on that. I think the daunting task for me is like, if you're running a whole campaign, you've got to come up with adventure after adventure, big overarching plot, whatever like that. You take that out of it and get down to that. That's a lot easier. There's still work, but that's much more manageable for anybody. Like you say, I think that's a great idea. I've never done that.
And
it's
kind
of like it's like circular storytelling. I have seen that kind of thing. And it's just like what you say, when you hand on to that next person, they go from there. Actually, they did that on Whose Line Is It Anyway?
That's where
I've seen that, where they would.
Watching that show a lot when in that time. So that might very well may have been where I got
the British version,
crappy American
one. The correct version, good version.
I liked both versions.
I like the American.
I thought
version.
The American. I think it's overly fashionable to say you like the British
same,
version.
The
I like
both versions. The half cast was the same, except Drew Carey. I like Drew Carey. But he wasn't as good as Clive.
I didn't
Clive
think Owen. That the
or Clive,
I didn't think it
his name
popped.
Was.
The American version, the jokes were funny, but it just didn't pop. It just wasn't like a firecracker. It just wasn't. It's hard to explain.
Quick aside here on two things that are coming up in the show before we
this show.
Not this episode. Fear of the Boot. No, not this episode. Before we stroll into our other topic for today, which actually we've kind of gotten into already on that tangent. But first off, with the GM profiles, we are still accepting your submissions. If you are interested in sending us your GM profile.
You know, we never actually told people how to get them to us.
Yeah, we did.
How?
We did. feartheboot@gmail.com.
Well, and the thing is,
I already have some.
Well, that's cool and all, but not everybody has like Audacity and the ability to record all that stuff. I was thinking too that don't we have like an Odeo account?
Yeah, back in the day? Unless it's gone dead because we never used it. But I'll dig around. If you can record these on your computer using like Audacity or any kind of Microsoft, like the Windows Wave Studio that comes free with your computer, whatever the equivalent is on Macs, and
we'll find a way to convert it.
Don't send us the Wave, because the Waves will be huge.
Yeah,
but if you can take those and search around online, you can actually convert them yourself. There's a site which is www.media-convert.com where you can just online upload and have your file instantly transfer and drop back down to you. Send us an MP3 and send it to feartheboot@gmail.com because our current feartheboot.com domain emails only have a relatively small mailbox size. So send them that Gmail account.
Up to 7 gigs now.
And we'll keep this open for a while because I know it's going to take you guys a while to record this and probably a while just to even figure out some of the technology involved if you're not already working with this kind of thing. But get those over to us, and at some point we'll take some of the more interesting clips and put them together into a bonus episode or something and drop it out there so you guys have a chance to give advice to each other on how
to
handle
it. So do you want to try and do an Odeo?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and reset up the Odeo account. It used to be, I think, odeo.com/feartheboot, if I remember right, but I'll reset it up, and if I don't have it, well, this show's going to drop tonight, so I won't have it for this show, but I'll have it for next week's show.
Yeah, we don't have a deadline right now, but we don't want to have this go on forever and ever and never actually release anything. So if you're thinking about doing, maybe I should, mae I shouldn't, just do it.
Don't procrastinate too long. Yeah, we're gonna let this go several weeks, but we're not gonna let this go for months. So if you're thinking about it, go ahead, hop up and do it. If you cannot figure out how to record sound on your computer, then hop over on the forums, and I'm sure somebody there, us or one of the listeners, will happily give you some advice on getting set up. I know we have a ton of podcasters that are on our forum, so stop
podcasters and tech geeks and
something else
around nerds.
Something else we're going to do next week that we kind of want to prep you guys for. For a while, we've been talking about doing something on this show to help you guys with outreach to people that have not gamed before. And that's what we are going to try and do next week. And here's what we're looking at. The first thing we're going to do is next week's topic is going to be about trying to explain to people what role-playing games are.
Yeah.
We'll also probably work a little bit on how to get past some of the more common arguments, how to get people to sit down and try them.
Basically, what we're talking about is how to sell a role-playing game.
Right.
Not sell it as in get somebody to buy it, but to buy into the concept. Like, you can have somebody who is really, really interested in role-playing games, but never touched an RPG before, but they're really curious about it, maybe want to get into it, really wants to try it, and how to, it's an easy sell, but how to approach them and sell that to them, all the way through to people who have serious issues with role-playing games. They think they're dangerous or satanic.
Jack Chick has explained them thoroughly, and that's all they need to know.
Yeah.
And
I mean, basically, and these are people who, you don't need to get into an argument with them. They're just miseducated, and they're misinformed. People have lied to them. And we're going to tell you, hopefully, how to put role-playing games in a positive light to the point to where they would either accept it or, you know, God forbid, want to play one.
And then what we're going to do to follow up on that is either next week or the week after, we're going to drop a one-shot episode that is going to be geared towards people who've never played a role-playing game. So you can take this episode, put it on a CD, email them the link to it, whatever you want to do. Let them listen to it. And this is not going to be to you helping them learn. This is going to be to them, to a non-gamer. Yes. We are going to explain to them carefully and methodically, this is what a role-playing game is. This is how
on
you play
a very
them.
Basic level, like, this person does not know what the concept of a role-playing game is. And this isn't going to be a roundtable debate format that we're going to use, kind of like how we do a roundtable discussion on a normal show. This is going to be an instructional MP3 that the first episode you've listened to, and you got your sales techniques, you've sold the game, the concept to the person, you can hand them this MP3, this CD, and this will tell them what a role-playing game is.
And we're going to follow that up with one more show. I don't know if this one will be a regular episode or a bonus, but we will explain, and we'll do another show explaining, okay, if you've now started role-playing, once again, to these same new players, we're assuming now they've been converted.
This is like the advanced basic.
Yeah, you won them over, that episode made sense to them, whatever, they've started role-playing. We're going to teach them the basics once you're trying the games. Here's how you understand the...
What's a D6?
Yeah.
Where do you buy a D6 at?
Where do you... What is percentile dice? Yeah. How do you roll those? How do you pick a game? Which there's so many systems and books out there.
Involved? How do you get involved?
Precisely. Exactly. So we're going to go over some of that stuff coming up here in the next couple episodes. The next topic we're going to talk about is something we actually had brought to us in episode 112. A guy, and I believe it was Jeremiah, skimming the show notes here real quick.
We could be wrong about that. I think it was Jeremiah.
We apologize to whoever it was. If you correct us, we will correct ourselves in the next episode. But he asked us about world campaigns and said he'd really never heard us talk about world campaigns on the show, and he wanted to know what our thoughts are on them. So let's start by I'm trying to find what a world campaign is, at least how I understood his question.
It is where you have a solar system.
Right.
And
everybody plays a world.
Everybody plays a planet. And they kind of, you know, it's just every few years they come close enough that they can talk.
Exactly.
These
campaigns are expected to go on for, 20, 30 billion years.
Yeah.
Yes. So
it's a real time commitment.
Right. So, yeah, you know, this is one that can last
from Venus.
I bet you do.
There once was a pat from Venus.
That's right.
When you normally play a campaign, you're the hero sent out to save the maiden from the dragon. You're the guys on the starship trying to understand why the crew of the other starship disappeared. But when you play a world campaign, you are at that high level. Mm-hmm. You're the movers, the shakers.
Do you think so? I think that you could take it from the other standpoint, too. But we'll get back to that.
This was a list.
Oh.
Possibility ones, you could be the movers and shakers. You're the presidents, generals, and kings. You're changing things in the realm. You could be the hero, the ordinary man, the extraordinary circumstance. But you're not just killing the dragon. You're toppling the three empires.
Smog
exactly. And so whatever it is you're doing, when you are done, this world will have forever changed in a massive and major way. And the opportunity this allows, or the problem it creates, however you choose to look at it, is if you ever run future campaigns in that same setting and you take the actions of the previous game to have been real canonical fact, it's not the same realm anymore. You know, if you play an old Forgotten Realms game and you kill Bane, then the next game you play, if you don't reset the world, a lot of stuff has changed.
I think that you can also play it from the perspective of maybe you aren't the big mover and shaker. You are the normal guy, normal adventurer, and things are happening around you that you don't necessarily have a hand in. But these events affect you and will continue on whether you're there or not. It would be like going to Europe. It's like, oh, Europe, it's nice. Okay, now we're going to Europe in World War II. You're not playing the person who kills Hitler, but all of these events are going on
And the world will not be the same thereafter.
It will not be the same thereafter, and they directly affect right. you. So if you stop playing in 1943, and you do a hiatus, you go and play Shadowrun. I say Shadowrun so much tonight because I'm looking at a second edition book. But, you go play Shadowrun, the group breaks up, there's drama, you guys go to college, you come back, and then everyone's friends gets like, let's play that World War II campaign again. Okay, now it's 1944, and what has happened? The world has gone on without you, and things have changed. So
I think one of the big reasons, and I've run some world campaigns, but I think one of the reasons I have not generally is because if I like a setting, mm-hmm. I like what's in the setting, I like the who's, what's, where's, and why's. I like all the things that are going on. And by the end of a world campaign, I have changed so much mm-hmm. that if I were to continue that, the next game would not be that setting. If I take Forgotten Realms and I just burn the countryside, yeah. all the gods fall from the sky and all this kind of stuff, the next game that I run, what does that have in common yeah. with Forgotten Realms anymore? Now, having said that, I'm not saying this is a bad idea. This is just why I personally don't tend to do it. Now, part of the neat thing of that is if you really like exploring a world, then this is a great opportunity. Because whatever happened in the first game, the next campaign, whether it's the same characters, different characters, their sons and daughters, who knows, whatever it is, you now get to explore what this radically different world is like. What is the world like in the reconstruction after World War II? Mm-hmm. And what kind of world are you going to build out of that? And that's great stuff to explore. Or look into other avenues of that plot that didn't get covered, like, go look into the Warsaw ghettos now that the Nazis are gone or yeah. whatever the case may be. But I personally like the flavor of the games that I play enough.
You like the flavor? Did they taste like bacon?
If they did, man, I would have no game books. I'd have eaten them all by now.
My the problem I have with the world campaign, I think world campaigns are fantastic ideas, and I would actually love to play in them. But I don't think I would want to run one, is because when I run a game, I like to focus down. And I like the politics and the intrigue.
Well, that is an enormous amount to keep track of.
Well,
worlds are not shaped by two people. They're shaped by,
See, that's what I want, though. I want the two people. I want the interpersonal, interactions. I want, what is going on between an NPC and a thing. The big, huge of what's going on and how the world is shaped, that's just backdrop to my kind of campaigns. I really like to take that focus in and take a micro focus to what's going on with the characters and stuff. It's not my thing to pull out and look at the macro focus of what's going on in the world. But like I said, that's just my sort of style. I would love to play in a game like that. But
I actually am. One of the long campaigns that I've been in, and I've been in two, the second campaign that I played in that is still an ongoing game is absolutely what you're calling a world campaign. My friend runs it. He made up an entire world within entire back history, big political thing of what's going on now. And it is absolutely, the characters that have played in it have affected it in the present in the world. And what their actions have done, it carries on. And it's funny that you mentioned it because they actually, we sort of started it back in the college days. And since then, those characters have aged in time. And now some of the children of the characters that originally started are now playing in the game, et cetera, et cetera. So it is, it has gone that way. But it is, like you said, there's a lot that goes into the planning of it. And just for me, myself and the guy that runs it, we have spent a lot of times just talking back and forth, hashing out, brainstorming ideas. Mm-hmm. Like we talked about before, I said, okay, this is what I'm trying to do. What would make sense or what's, kind of cool. So there's a lot of work involved, but it's doable because, I think he's done a really good job at it. And it's a compelling story, mm-hmm. And you really do tend to get invested in it, I think, just because, there's a lot of it there that you sort of had a hand in shaping, I guess. Yeah. So I've enjoyed it. It's fun.
I think that's one of the best aspects of world campaigns is you get a sense that what you're doing is really epic. It really matters. You're not just killing the goblins in this one cave. Mm-hmm. You are dealing with powers that affect everyone and everything. Right. And the world is forever going to remember you, not because of the folk songs that were written about you, but because of the newspaper headings about you.
Yeah.
Let's work through a couple problems that can occur in a world campaign and try to kick around how you can deal with those. First one that comes to mind is power creep. You get out there, and this is going to be particularly bad in fantasy. I don't think it's going to be as bad in sci-fi, because most sci-fi games don't have the absurd level and equipment curve that fantasy games have. But you get out there, kill off the orcs that are threatening the countryside. They're not there anymore.
And you ding, you level up.
Yeah. And now what's going to threaten you? Orcs can't threaten you anymore.
Right.
They're not there. And even if they were there, you just beat them again. So now it's going to have to be the dragon flight. And then it's going to have to be the gods. And then it's going to have to be some... And the whole thing quickly...
Yeah, I think that you can have a fan. I mean, I see the danger in it,
right?
But I think that you can have a fantasy game where it's about like the politics and the. I mean, come on, medieval Europe, one of the Crusades. We go in, we actually, you know, kick the Middle Easterners' butt in the Crusades. But is that where it ended? No, they came back and they ran us out of the Holy Lands and stuff, and they ran us all the way back to Europe. And you know,
except Acre, but
well, yeah, but you know, it went back and forth. And, you know, I think in fantasy games, you can have that too. It's just like, are you genociding the orcs? Maybe the answer is yes. Maybe the players need to deal with concept.
Perhaps I should have been deep. A little more specific there in that the issue is not fantasy games.
Right.
The issue is if you are doing a combat heavy sort of run in a fantasy game that has a steep level in equipment.
If you're doing like a min-maxed combat Monty Hall campaign, why are you even bothering doing the extra work of a world campaign?
You know,
bigger, deeper dungeons. I mean, that's what you want.
It's going to go really fast.
Kill more monsters, get more loot. I mean, that's kind of what you're there for. But
you know, we didn't have the problem really with power creep in the world that I was talking about, just because, you know, I don't think we didn't have the equipment and the power curve like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was always from the get-go, this was intended to be almost a never-ending story kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was not the in two sessions you're going to be, you know, have advanced a level and et cetera, et cetera. It just sort of went along. This was also more of a homebrewed system that he was using anyway too, so it made it a little bit more open in there too.
I think that's one of the advantages or one of the positive things you can do is that don't use a setting that pre-exists. I think that you kind of constrain yourself when you do that. It's not impossible, but you're kind of putting limits on yourself. I think that if you're writing a book or you have this whole world, this whole setting and all these characters in your mind, or you just come up with it for this game, that offers you a lot of leeway and such, you know, to write in the things, because you reveal it to the characters as they come. So if the characters... You know, you're playing Forgotten Realms and the characters kill Moander or whatever, you know, before he's supposed to die or he's not supposed to die, then that changes. It doesn't end the campaign, but it changes the story of Forgotten Realms in a way that it wasn't supposed to be changed. So now you've got to work around that and change. Just make your own setting, you know.
I don't know. I personally like what you're saying is exactly correct. But having said that, I still like running this kind of game in an existing setting. But
what if everybody wants to run in Forgotten Realms?
Right, you know, by the time it's done, it's so mutilated that, you really shouldn't bother buying any more products for it.
It
has nothing to do with the game you're running. Along those lines, though, this actually leads to the next problem I can think of with this type of game. You don't like the world thereafter. It was fun wrecking the playground, and it's not so fun.
And we should say, it's not necessarily a matter of wrecking the playground. It's... The story has completely changed.
Right. So much has changed that you don't really like the world anymore.
Yeah.
Or just it's so different in feel that you really, this isn't what you want out of a game anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Along those lines, it's not, epic stuff is only cool because it's epic.
Right.
And it's only epic because other things aren't. And so they're going to hit this point where it's like you spend your whole game sitting session after session after session after session dealing with dragons and gods and big political movements and fleet dispositions and all this kind of stuff. And pretty soon that becomes.
So what you're saying is like going up to Mount Olympus and telling Zeus my way or the highway and kicking him in the nuts, not necessarily even the combat thing, but just like the politics, that becomes very pedestrian after a while.
Yes, exactly. That becomes just as boring.
Oh, God, Mount Olympus again.
Yeah, there's nothing exciting about it. It doesn't excite you anymore. Whereas if you have a campaign where through most of it, you're dealing with relatively, in the scheme of the world, trivial things. Mm-hmm. And then you have this one big moment in the spotlight where everything hinges on you. And then you go back to dealing with trivial things. That moment has a significance. It will that
when you read like through history and stuff, and you read like biographies and memoirs of people, the thing I've noticed is that most people who make a historical impact only do so maybe once or twice in their lifetime. Yeah. There are a handful of people, you know, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander the Great, the big movers and shakers who like keep hitting history and hitting history and hitting history over and over again. And, you know, does that affect your suspension of disbelief? If you have a group of five or six people who keep hitting those historical, they are making history or changing history through every adventure that they do. Or is that just some, that's what you want out of a campaign?
I think it's one of the big things you've got to do to make this run right is you have to understand why and how are these characters affecting history? Are they doing it just because they're the big badasses that no one can threaten?
Or are they?
You know, is it something like you're playing a ruling dynasty?
Right.
Is it something, you know, because that is going to set the tone and pace of the entire campaign and also how much plot there's going to be.
Yeah, that gives me an idea, too. Who says that you have to play the same character?
Yeah.
You know, like you said, ruling dynasty. You know, maybe you're playing generations of characters.
And I've never played in these campaigns, but I know people who have, where they play their characters to a certain point, and then they play the character's son or daughter or a friend of theirs or a retainer that they picked up somewhere
along
the way.
Wouldn't it be cool to play a mob campaign? You're in America, there's no magic or anything like that, and you start out in the 1930s and you're a street gang, and you know they're just had prohibition, and you build it up, and then you play this sort of generational campaign of a mafia family all the way up to modern day. You know, it's like you get out of booze and you start getting into prostitutes and drugs, and you know,
waste management
and times change. And you have to change with that. I mean, that would be a great one because you've got a world that's continual. Times change. You have an effect on the world. You're doing great. You're not doing great things. Like as in,
well, in context,
yeah,
you're doing noteworthy, significant things.
Yes.
Significant.
Yes.
Yeah. I, you know what you're saying with your characters, it sounds like you set a goal for yourself. Like what Dan was saying, you get these characters and maybe they have this goal. And once they achieve that goal, maybe then it's time to retire that character and move on to something else. Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, too, what you were talking about, Dan, is I think as far as the epic goes, it's almost like as the GM responsibility, I think, is when you're setting this up, setting up like a world campaign, you've got to think about it in terms of a properly scaled epic adventures. Like you're saying, if you're going up against Mount Olympus and Zeus, well, what's really beyond that?
Yeah. Right.
You know, so, you know, you've got to think, well, we don't want to do that, but we can certainly have epic things in the scheme of things that are still epic, but they're not like, you know, on the realm of the creator. You know,
you can also look at the way the characters are interacting with that campaign, because, for example, if we look at World War II, I can talk about how someone like Oppenheimer changed the course of that war. At no point did Oppenheimer slap on his powered armor and take his twin miniguns and lay waste to the Japanese coast.
That's only because you believe in the, you know, that
the
fake propaganda
that you've been fed. I mean, come on. But we all know what Oppie was capable
of.
Another example would be the sniper at Stalingrad.
Yes.
The way, you know, and here's these people.
What's his name? They did the Vasily, Enemy at the Gates Zaitsev movie, but that movie sucked. So much cooler.
Vasily Zaitsev was
That guy was awesome.
And then the German guy, I forget his name, but
Who cares? He died.
Exactly.
He lost.
He took
the
scope.
That's right.
He traded the Iron Cross for a stone one.
Do you know that in the history of that, they were on this, you know, wrecked field, right? In Stalingrad or St. Petersburg, whatever you want to call it. And it was this wrecked city and all this trash bombed area and stuff. And they had the Russian sniper guy, and they had like his friend, like who was in the movie, but this is what really happened, who was with the Russian propaganda corps. Mm-hmm. And they're like hunting this guy and he's hunting them. And the propaganda guy stands up and goes, there he is. Boom. Head's gone.
Yeah.
And so they're like, the both snipers don't move. And they're there for like a day, maybe 2 days, not moving, just looking for each other. Mm. And the Russian guy sees a little bit of movement, takes his shot, and kills the guy. He was behind a steel plate, like part of a building or a piece of armor from a tank or something. That's where he was hiding from. Shot him through that.
Wow.
And killed him.
Huh.
But yeah, great story. No, but in the movie, they're standing 3 feet away and he's delivering like crap lines or something.
Yeah, it's yeah.
I've never seen the movie, but I mean, getting back to
it's actually okay movie. It's actually pretty decent.
But getting back to the point at hand, you know, here's people there. And I think that helps keep the significance of it, because when you are affecting history in such careful, minimal ways, then it keeps a significance and it keeps a danger level to everything that's going on. It's not like at some point you just obliterate everything and nothing thereafter really seems to excite you anymore, because the next situation is just as difficult as the previous one. And I think that applies even if you want to be the big prime mover and shaker. I mean, you know what? A king is not unbeatable.
Yeah. That's right.
And
unless he's in powered armor.
Well, right.
Twin powered armor,
twin miniguns. Yeah. But you know, you go out and you subdue the countryside, there's always the next rebellion.
Yeah.
And that keeps it moving along in a way that I don't think you can get if you're affecting I don't think you can get if you're affecting history as a hero.
There's a great anime called 12 Kingdoms that's about that, sort of a fantasy anime. And it's about this girl who is a normal girl and she's chosen to be empress. And like the first 10 episodes or so are about her trying to come to terms and all the struggle with becoming an empress, and nobody believes her. And then there's like this rebellion, right? They're trying to like the civil war against her, and then she fights it. And then she becomes empress. In like 10 episodes later, she becomes empress and her power is solid. But that's not the end of the show.
Right.
It is her consolidating power and you know, the quelling rebellion and doing all this stuff. So, yeah, who says that becoming king has to be the end goal?
Right. And I think something else that allows you for in future campaigns is you can go back to the micro level, that after you've changed the world, sometimes going back to that street level to see what's really going on.
Yeah. Oh, my God. She did that in 12 Kingdoms. She dressed up as a peasant and was walking around so that she could get a real idea of what her kingdom was like.
Right.
Yeah.
But it kind of brings it, you know, once again, you finished World War II and okay, now in the next campaign, we're all teenagers in the Warsaw ghetto. The Nazis are gone, but now the communists are here.
Yeah.
And what life is like and trying to survive through that. And all these things are occurring back to the micro level. Gives you a great, you know, every analogy we've used in this episode is either fantasy, either D&D or World War II.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, it's kind of struck me that we're doing nothing but D&D and World War II epic campaigns that we're going to break up with Shadowrun games.
Yeah, we're really pigeonholing ourselves here, man.
I have always wanted to play a World War II game, and I could never get anybody to play a World War II game with me. Because there was that Superheroes World War II game, I forget what it's called, and I wanted to play, I want to play Superheroes game, World War II, that's dumb. And then I just want to play, like, can we play Band of Brothers or something, the role-playing game? That would be awesome. All right, I'm done now.
Okay. All right, then I guess we'll go ahead and close this one off on Chad's rant. We'll just let him continue yelling and seething as the mics go off. So, thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Get off my lawn! See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.